This is another iRaw podcast.
You recognize that meaning is being co-created in every single situation, that a tree or a rock has a very particular meaning for a particular animal or insect, for example. A different kind of meaning has a different resonance than it would for you.
Welcome back to The Animal Turn, everybody. If you joined us in season one, you'll know that I am a graduate student myself, currently undertaking my PhD in geography here at Queen's University in Canada. And I don't really know that much about animal studies. I'm moving into that direction and I'm learning a great deal as I undertake my own graduate work. And I had no idea that in between learning about all of this, I would decide to launch this podcast. So this podcast is very much an exploration. It's learning about ideas and animal studies concepts. And I'm hoping that you'll join me on this journey as we learn about animals and what their worlds are like. And this takes us a bit into what season two is going to be about. In season two, we're going to talk and focus on animals and experience. So in season one, we looked at the nitty-gritty of animals and law. What are some of the really key and important concepts to keep in mind when you're trying to think about animals and our legal systems? And really, I had no idea that their lives were so deeply shaped by our legal systems. The extent to which we view them as property completely curtails their ability to move, their ability to have any sort of standing in a courtroom. And this really opened my eyes up to a whole new world. And in a very different way, season two is going to do the same, or at least I hope it will. Instead of looking at laws and legal structures, I'm going to instead shift gears and try to understand how we can know how animals experience the world. Now, that was a messy and complicated sentence, and I have a feeling we're going to be doing a fair bit of mental stretching in season two. Anything that works or delves in the realm of experience tends to be messy and tends to be hard to grapple with and understand. And I kind of like it that way. I think when explanations are too simple or too categorical, I start to get a bit squeamish. Nothing is simple, nothing is easy, and maybe I'm just a sucker for punishment. Who knows? But I'm extremely excited for season two to learn, or at least try to think about some of the concepts that will help in my own journey, and I hope in yours too, for thinking about how animals might actually experience the world. So that brings us to episode one. And I thought that episode one would be, you know, to start off with a key concept like phenomenology. Now you're going to hear a couple of times, both myself and Zipporah will mispronounce this word in this episode because for some reason, it's a tongue twister. And I'm really thrilled that she stumbled on it too, because it made me feel a lot better about myself and the fact that I almost always say this word wrong. So Zipporah Weisberg is an independent scholar, an animal activist, and a contemporary dancer currently living in Granada, Spain. You'll hear that we have some delay in our conversation. I tried my best to edit that in post-production, and unfortunately what that did end up requiring was for me to mute one of our microphones while the other was speaking, because we're both pretty vocal speakers, and sometimes our ums and our mm-hmms and our yes were just a little bit off when we were speaking. So they became more of a distraction than really something that was helping the conversation along. Because of this delay, there were also one or two minor sound issues that came up towards the end of the podcast. You're going to hear that there's some crackling, and I wasn't too sure how to repair or fix that. But you can still hear what's going on, and in general, I think things went really well. So as I'm learning about animal studies, I'm also certainly learning a lot about sound and sound production. But back to Zipporah. So Zipporah is an independent scholar, and her area of specialization includes critical animal studies, critical theory from the early Frankfurt School, existentialism, as well as phenomenology. In 2013, Zipporah completed her PhD in social and political thought at York University and was awarded the Apple Postdoc Fellowship, which was renewed for a second year, and that is here at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. During the tenure of her fellowship, Zipporah's research focused on the ethics of biotechnology as well as on phenomenology of animal life. And this led her to writing two publications. One is Biotechnology as Endgame, Ontological and Ethical Collapse in the Biotech Century. And we're not really going to be speaking much about the biotechnological side of her work today. Rather, we're going to be focusing a bit more on some of the ideas that she extrapolated and unpacked in a paper called The Simple Magic of Life, Phenomenology and Reenchantment. Zipporah is also currently working on a paper about interspecies friendship and the politics of Eros. So I'm extremely excited. We had a really wonderful conversation. We spoke a lot about how Zipporah came to think about animals and experience and the twists and turns that her own graduate studies took to find her where she currently is. And then we delve into what the concept of phenomenology is, which is experience. And you'll hear from our conversation that it's really not an easy and straightforward endeavor to try and understand another's experience. Welcome to The Animal Turn, and thank you so much for your patience with all of the technical difficulties we've been running into. It seems we have a bit of a lag because we're speaking from very far distances. I'm in Ontario and you're all the way in Spain, is that correct?
That's right. Yes, I am in the south of Spain, and we have very bad internet connections here in the little ancient barrio or neighborhood that I live in. So it's probably coming from my end. So I apologize for that. But thank you so much for inviting me onto the show. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here.
No need to apologize. I'm super excited to have you here. Will Kimlicka and Sue Donaldson, you know, said that you are just amazing. And if there's anyone who I want to speak to about with regards to phenomenology, it's you. So I am thrilled to have you here with me today.
That's wonderful.
You were at Apple from 2013 to 2015, is that correct?
Yes. Actually, I was technically the Abby Benjamin postdoctoral fellow in animal ethics in the Department of Philosophy at Queen's University, under the formal supervision of Dr. Will Kimlicka and the informal supervision, guidance, and friendship of Sue Donaldson. It was a fantastic experience, really one of the best I've ever had academically, intellectually, and as an activist as well. I have nothing but good things to say about my time there, not just in terms of the community that we developed with other graduate students, undergraduate students as well, but also just in terms of the working relationship that I had with Will and Sue.
Well, that's so great to hear. I'm developing that kind of relationship with them here myself. So as a current graduate speaking to a former graduate, it's really nice to connect with you. And again, I'm thrilled to have you here as the first person on season two. So season two is going to focus on animals and experience. But before we get into the focus of today's episode, which is on phenomenology, which I'm going to mispronounce at some point during today's episode. I don't know what it is, but my brain, it just always misses this word, phenomenology. But before we get into what that concept is and how it relates to animals and experience, maybe you could tell me a little bit about how you got interested in animals and animal studies.
Sure. And I will just add that I was just thinking about that the other day because I was speaking with another friend about phenomenology and he was also stumbling over the word. And I thought, you know, couldn't they have thought of a better word, an easier word to say? Because it happens to me as well. It happens to everyone. So don't worry at all about that. And it'll probably happen throughout the show today as well for me. So yeah, I guess my relationship, you could say, with the world of animal ethics and animal politics, and eventually critical animal studies, goes back almost 20 years, if I can say that. That's remarkable. That makes me feel very old. But when I was an undergraduate student at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, just a suburb of Vancouver, I got involved with an animal liberation organization on campus, our main focus there was trying to expose the animal research that was taking place on campus. We even met with the committee, I can't remember, the Animal Care Committee is what they called themselves, misleadingly, for something quite minor, but at the same time important, which was to reveal the true nature of their facility on the campus map. They just used the acronym, whereas all other departments and facilities use the full name, but just to draw attention to what was actually happening on campus. So that sort of opened my eyes to the issue of animal research and animal experimentation. But there was also this terrible place that was known as the so-called chicken factory, which was actually in full view on the main road leading up to the university. And I passed by that on a daily basis and saw with my own eyes the sheer horror that was taking place. There were trucks filled with absolutely terrified, injured, abused chickens standing in all sorts of inclement weather for hours on end, waiting to be unloaded to be slaughtered. You could even see the slaughter, the beginning of the slaughter area. I couldn't actually see chickens being slaughtered, but you could see the kind of assembly line band that goes round that these poor creatures are hung up onto with one leg. And there was a very strong smell, a stench that came from this terrible place. And it just became absolutely obvious to me that there was simply no way that I could participate in this violence. And really, the moment I sort of learned about what this place was, what was happening there, I became vegan. I had been learning a little bit about other aspects of the animal industrial complex. I didn't know that term at the time, but I had been learning about factory farming and about animal experimentation, as I mentioned. And I'm actually telling you this in reverse order. I had become a vegan before I joined the animal rights group on campus. But anyway, this was a period in general of learning. But then this really just hammered it home, so to speak, that this was a fundamental responsibility of mine to adopt, a vegan politics and ethics.
Wow. Okay. So you went to university, you were exposed to animal slaughter, chickens being abused, and then became aware of the different ways in which animals are used, so both for food, but also in research facilities. And you had mentioned earlier that you wanted to expose how the animals were being used in your university. Do you know what kind of research was actually being conducted there?
It's a long time ago, I have to say, they were doing a research on cats and on rabbits. I can tell you more about the animals than the actual nature of the research. I don't recall the specifics because it was such a long time ago, but they actually allowed us to come into the facility, which I doubt would occur today, to have a tour, quote unquote, of the facility. They wanted to show us that the animals were just fine. And this was their approach. And they also had tanks full of various fish species that they were doing experiments on. I'm not even going to pretend to remember what kinds of experiments, because that would just be misleading. All I can tell you is the visceral impact of the visit. I mean, there were cats in this kind of like store window area where there was like a plexiglass window, and then the cats were just sort of piled together in this like windowsill, just a slightly larger than normal windowsill where you would see like a mannequin on display. That's the space the cats had, and they looked quote unquote okay at first glance in terms of the fact that they didn't have lesions or abrasions. There were no signs of physical abuse, but physical abuse can also be invisible to the naked eye, and certainly psychological abuse is a major factor here. We also saw rabbits in sort of large Tupperware containers just sitting there in a box of plastic, just alone, isolated in a dark room, and fish in small tanks just swimming round and round. So it was a very moving experience just to witness this institutional violence with our own eyes.
Well, this was something that came up in season one, where I spoke to Siobhan O'Sullivan. So she's done a bit of work on visibility. And, you know, I think about the visibility of lab animals, and I've never, maybe we're exposed somewhat to it in schools, or some schools where vivisection is still something that happens. But, you know, my exposure to any of these sorts of animals has been really quite limited. So that must have been quite an evocative experience for you, as you say. So you've been now exposed to a variety of animals in a variety of situations. How did you find yourself, you know, looking at philosophy? Were you already enrolled in a philosophy course, or did this somehow influence your journey?
Right. That's a really interesting question. So actually at this time, I was studying theater, physical theater, to be precise. I was in a very different world. I got a terrible mark on my on the one and only philosophy paper that I tried to write. It was on Kant's categorical imperative, and I really botched that one. I think I was up too late rehearsing. So I was in a different world, a very studio-based training. I think there was far too little sort of intellectual activity in that program. If I were to go back and offer some feedback, that's one of the things I would say. But so I didn't get exposed to, I didn't know that critical animal studies even existed. And it hadn't even occurred to me to study anything related to the question of animal exploitation or liberation. I was really approaching the issue from the standpoint of an activist. I also worked a little bit with the Vancouver Humane Society, which is much more than a typical humane society. It's really a radical animal liberation organization. So I did some volunteering with them, was very active in the campus group, and started involving myself in other projects as well, with other sort of community activist groups, including one called Public Works, where we came up with a kind of culture jamming, a culture jamming action. I'm not sure what I think of this now. It actually could be quite troubling when I look back on it, in terms of its implications. But we, culture jamming and the approach of this group was to kind of use humor to make people uncomfortable about a glaring injustice in late capitalist society. And so I wanted to draw attention to the so-called chicken factory, which really people just ignored. It was so visible, if we're talking about visibility, it was so visible that it became invisible, right? It's just like another, thing that you pass by, just like the store, you know, or the McDonald's, or whatever it is that you pass by on your bus or your bike, on the bus or your bike. And so I wanted to bring real uncomfortable visibility to this place. And, you know, people complained about the smell, but that was almost aesthetic, right? They were concerned, it bothered them, but they didn't actually ask, you know, what the ethics of that smell were, what was actually going on to create that smell. So we did a little, we created a pamphlet. We invited parents and their children, of course we knew they wouldn't come, to a Disneyland style tour of the factory. We sort of focused on, and we handed out these pamphlets and tried to create this image that it was a happy, fun place to go, because what we were doing was drawing on the happy, fun images that we see in advertising to kind of erase the brutal reality, you know, the pictures of and images of happy chickens and happy cows in fields and so on. So we were playing a little bit with that. Again, I'm not sure that I would do that again today, but that was sort of my first experience with the kind of experience with activism, also in direct contact with the public. Like, we went around, we dressed up, and we handed out these pamphlets to people and tried to gauge their reactions, which were mixed.
Well, certainly subversive, I think.
Yeah, you could say that. You could say that. Although now I think that the humor, I think in this case, was problematic because there was just such extreme violence taking place there that I do think humor doesn't have a place in certain situations. I understand the strategy that we used. I understand that we had good intentions, but I would not do that again now that I think about it and talk about it. I feel like there are other ways of raising awareness about places that are so visible, they're invisible.
So how did this then get you interested in the world of philosophy?
Yeah, okay, right. So a lot of things happened. I went to Poland, taught English, studied well, performed in a physical theater group there as well. I had just become vegan, so going to Poland was a challenge because veganism 20 years ago in Poland was really not a thing. It was really difficult to make that work, but I did, and I in a way appreciated the challenge because it just confirmed my commitment. But yeah, so after that, I felt that I did need to be more of a part of the activist community in a more committed and comprehensive way. So I joined, I became an employee actually of Global Action Network. It no longer exists, but it was a very effective and quite well-known animal liberation organization in Montreal. And that's where I started sort of getting more in touch with the academic side of things. But I actually started with religious studies. Again, I was a very naive at this stage and really didn't know much about anything. I was, you know, exploring these issues from a sort of purely activist point of view, if you can say that, meaning I wasn't reading a lot. I didn't even know there was anything to read about these issues. I was looking at footage of animal violence, which was incredibly traumatizing, I have to say, and is the impacts of which I still feel today. And, you know, speaking to people on the street, going to protests, organizing protests, those kinds of things, right? But I did have a friend who was studying Buddhism, and it didn't even occur to me to go into philosophy. I became intrigued by this religious tradition called Jainism, which predates Buddhism. I won't go into the details about it. But what I was intrigued by after seeing all of this brutality and also indifference to the brutality that we were all very well aware of at that point, even 20 years ago, was this religious tradition that prioritized ahimsa or non-harm to all living beings over everything else. That was its main guiding principle. And I then registered for a master's program in religious studies with a focus on Jainism. First, I started at Concordia to get some qualifying credits, and then I ended up at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London in London, England. And so I did my master's in Jainism and learned a lot about the tradition, read the ancient texts in English. wasn't quite at the point of being able to read them in the original Prakrit or other languages. And was really, really blown away, I have to say, by the degree of commitment that these people had towards all living beings. Just, it was so fully integrated and is in many Jains' lives, still fully integrated into their daily lives. And it's taken for granted that causing harm to another, no matter what shape or size or species, is fundamentally wrong and something that should be painstakingly avoided. So that then led me to my first PhD program. So a long sort of meandering story, because it took me a while to find my way to what became my home, my academic and intellectual home. But I long story short, I ended up at McMaster University in the religious studies program there, which was actually more of an interdisciplinary religious studies and philosophy program. So I was getting closer. but I did transfer in the end to first to humanities at York University and finally to social and political thought. In the meantime, this is at York University as well. And social and political thought is the perfect kind of department for someone like me, because it's very interdisciplinary by nature. It's not even actually a department, it's a program, and it's made up of professors from different departments and of students from all sorts of departments as well, who have a shared interest in philosophy, political theory, and social theory. So that's where, and even earlier, I would say already at McMaster is when I started to read and even discover that such a thing as critical animal studies existed.
That's an incredible journey with many, many twists and turns, and really interesting in terms of the many ways in which you experienced animals. So you were an activist first, you've seen animals, and you've been in a variety of different spaces yourself. So it's kind of, I think it's interesting that we're speaking today about phenomenology, which is also the study of experience. But and actually, I'm going to ask you to define it, because I'm not a philosopher, and you clearly have more knowledge in that regard than I do. But it sounds like you've had a lot of worldly experiences too. So I think it's kind of interesting to think through how travel and exposure to a variety of different spaces has also shaped, you know, your interest in the idea of experience. But let me backtrack a bit. Perhaps you could tell me, because the focus of today's episode is on phenomenology, there was that pause just before I said it to make sure I said it right, phenomenology. Could you give me, in a very brief way, a kind of, and I know it's near impossible, but what is it for the layman, for the everyday person? What are we talking about here?
Right. Good question. I wish I had looked this up before our interview. I'm just saying, I'm joking because it's been a while since I've actually been really engaged in phenomenology myself. I'm very comfortable with the discipline, really, because it is the study of consciousness, you could say. And it's also the study of perception. So what are beings' lived experiences? And, I can talk especially about Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who's the phenomenologist that I was most interested in and that resonated most with me, and that seems to be the most directly relevant to issues around animal exploitation and animal liberation. So it's really, very general terms, it would be the study of consciousness and perception. But for Merleau-Ponty, the question of embodiment, the relationship between, or even difference between, I think more precisely, perception and cognition, the relationship between beings or subjects and their lived world, what is called the Umwelt in phenomenology speak. So I don't know if that's a very good definition, but that's how I understand phenomenology. Let's put it that way.
So phenomenology is the study of consciousness and perception. But I think to many of us, I would say, how are those two things different from one another? What is the difference between consciousness and perception?
That's a really interesting question. I've actually never thought about what is the difference between consciousness and perception, because what I think about and what I've learned through my readings of Merleau-Ponty and others is that perception is part and parcel of consciousness, and consciousness is embodied. I know these are difficult concepts to get one's head around, particularly in the age of science. They can come across as quasi-scientific, so one has to suspend one's disbelief a little bit, I think, for phenomenology to make sense. So there are a lot of very big terms for what is actually something that is in some senses very intuitive, I think.
Most of phenomenology is not really concerned with the non-human world, or is this predominantly an animal studies concept?
Right. Yeah, that's also a very good question. So you're absolutely right that certainly the earlier phenomenologists were not per se interested in animals, although by its very nature, certainly the phenomenology of Merleau-Ponty and even his predecessor Husserl, less so Heidegger, it kind of has to take into account other animals. And I do think Husserl was the first one to do this in his discussions of intersubjectivity, but I'm not going to really get into that because it's a bit technical. I'm more interested in Merleau-Ponty because what makes Merleau-Ponty relevant to animal studies is his focus on embodiment. That's also one of these terms that's thrown around a lot, but it's really important the way that he develops this term, the way that he uses it, because it's a challenge to what our civilization really has been plagued with for centuries, which is Cartesian dualism, this idea that the mind and the body are separate somehow, and that reason presides over the body, and that there is even such a thing as a kind of quasi-disembodied reason. So again, without getting into the details of that, what Merleau-Ponty does is he offers an alternative way of understanding how we make sense of the world. You know, there are also challenges to empiricism and idealism, but I don't want to bore you with that.
Oh, no, you're not boring us at all.
Okay. he wants to challenge the idealist conception of a sovereign subject, of this kind of all-thinking subject that imposes categories of understanding on the external world, as though the world is external to begin with. Right. And he's also challenging kind of the empiricist idea that we are sort of passive recipients of sensory data. So he's finding a kind of middle ground by saying, wait a second, Isn't there another way that we actually engage with the world? We are bodies after all. So, you know, when we sit down, when we're speaking at this very moment, our whole body is engaged in this activity, in this dialogue. We're not just minds, even though we're talking about phenomenology and philosophy, these lofty topics. We're talking about them as lived bodies. And that can mean many different things as well, right? We're lived bodies in many different ways, and not getting into the whole politics of embodiment. But what Merleau-Ponty teaches us is that the body is a seat of consciousness, and we are beings that are shaped by the perceptual experience of an embeddedness in the world. And he also draws on Jakob von Uxkull, who was actually a Baltic German zoologist, who was not per se a phenomenologist, but whose writings are definitely similar in tone and in aim, I would say, to phenomenology, where they're talking about the life worlds of different beings. So rather than sort of viewing us as either these kind of bodiless minds floating around, making, you know, concrete analyses of the world around us using these fixed categories of understanding, or as just being these kind of passive bodies just taking in sensory data, Merleau-Ponty and also Uxkull before him wanted to explore how we are co-creating the worlds around us, that we live in these, we inhabit worlds, and these worlds are multiple, right? So I'm not talking about the world of human beings on the earth. I'm talking about, or even a social world. I'm talking about a world with the lived environment in which you are situated at this very moment, seated on the couch, or walking in a forest, or for an animal in a factory farm, or in a safe place like a sanctuary or interspecies community, among others. So we co-create worlds with the lived environment and also with other subjects. So one of the big words in phenomenology is intersubjectivity, that we're constantly co-creating through our own entanglement, our intersubjective intertwining. There are all these beautiful, a little bit wordy words, but still, I think, very moving somehow. That we're co-creating worlds with each other. And so what that does is that creates the foundation for a much more immediate sense of empathy, okay? Because we are co-situated. I think Elizabeth Benke talked about that. And so we are experiencing the world in a sense as another being is experiencing the world, even though we never quite know, and this is very important, we never quite know what another being, even what another human being is experiencing at any given moment, even if we feel we've experienced that before.
Just so that I'm, because you've given us a lot to think about there. So phenomenology is in general concerned with experience, and I'm gathering now from what you're saying, the experience of the first person, how is a being experiencing the world? But based on what you're saying here, not just that they're experiencing it as individuals, that the position you take is that consciousness is born of the body or is the body, but that it's not an individual necessarily, that wherever experience is, it tends to be created with either other beings or other environments. So it's never isolated. Is that kind of on the right track?
Yeah, that's a really nice way to put it. And it's not to say, so I would just add a caveat that although, yes, we're constantly co-creating, and I should add a really important word here, which is meaning, okay? The world is filled with what Uxkull calls carriers of meaning. So any object, which could be another subject, that we engage with is a carrier of meaning for us. It carries meaning. It's really quite a simple term. It has meaning. It carries meaning. So it actually has an active role in that meaning. But yes, we're co-producing, co-creating, and co-constituting the world and the worlds within which we live. On the other hand, although we are constantly involved in intersubjective relations, we are very much within our own private subjective worlds. And this is particularly important for animal ethics and politics because it emphasizes the sheer variety of non-human animal life and experience, Each animal, although we tend to think of them now as just these sort of faceless automatons in, you know, in factory farms, or these meat objects, right? Meat producing objects and commodities, even though they've been genetically altered and bred, they are still very much deeply feeling, deeply perceiving individuals. And that term itself is loaded, but so I might say subjects, individual subjects or unique subjects.
So what you're saying is even though we speak about maybe chickens or dogs or cows as these kind of mass groups, that what's really jarring is when you start to think, okay, each individual that's going through that process is having an individual experience, even though they're creating it, that experience is part of a broader, so you've brought up factory farms, a part of a broader structure in which they're being killed and sold. They're part of this bigger environment, but each individual therein has an experience of that world.
That's a very nice way to put it. Absolutely. And this is one of the things that I think see, I did it. I knew it would happen at least once. So phenomenology is really useful in highlighting just how horrible the placing of these animals in sterile, barren environments is, not to mention environments where extreme violence is taking place every second. Because phenomenology shows us, and this is a beautiful part of Uxkull's book that I've got right here, A Foray into the Worlds of Animals and Humans, where he talks about the effect. He uses this term, and he calls it, for example, something like the love effect. So a hen, she might be sitting on her eggs and keeping them warm, the little beings that are coming to life inside there and waiting for them to hatch. And so for her, the nest could take on a nest tone or a home tone, we could say, or a care tone, but it also maybe takes on a love tone. So this is sort of a slightly esoteric terminology, but the idea is to get across that it's not just we need to make sure that the chicken, you know, has enough space, you know, to move 1 inch from one side to the other, right? With the, for example, with certain welfare proposals that people offer, these beings aren't mechanical, and it's not just about preventing suffering, as Peter Singer would argue, or enriching their environment, so-called, as others would argue, as welfarists would argue. What's happening here is that the whole experience of being a mother, in the case of a hen, is completely destroyed, obviously, in a battery cage. And it's not just that she's in a battery cage, she's being physically and psychologically tortured, but she, that whole lived experience of the love tone that she might have felt on sitting on the nest is gone, is taken from her. Okay. On the other hand, you have the negative side of that, which is to say, so you know, for a pig who's in a gestation crate, a sow, for her the gestation crate, these bars, right, that surround her, that rub against her skin, that torture her, that prevent her from moving around, lying down, doing anything remotely related to what she would naturally want to do and need to do, take on a terror tone, for example. Now, of course, it's accuse me, us, of anthropomorphizing, but I don't think that's really the point here. Where what phenomenology does is it provides a gateway into imagining empathically and with humility what it might be like, and intuitively through our own experience of what it might be like to be trapped in that same kind of environment. We can't know because we're not that pig, but we can imagine that, you know, if you're in a white room in a beautiful place, that whiteness might take on a bright tone for you. It might mean brightness, openness, right? But if you're in a white laboratory with white walls, it takes on, again, a horror tone for you if you're a macaque or a dog in a research laboratory.
But Sapora, so you spoke there a bit about anthropomorphism, and we can't necessarily know what another animal is going through necessarily. And I imagine, as you said, that this would be you know, a pretty big critique against, you know, anytime you maybe speak about an animal experience, something, someone will turn to you and say, well, that's just anthropomorphic. You have no way of knowing what they're going through. And, you know, you said that it's beside the point, but in many ways, I think that this is cutting to the heart of the critiques that would come against us. So maybe knowing how to respond is perhaps useful because, right. You know, I think someone I'd once said something very similar to a friend, and she had said to me, okay, but you might be speaking to a farmer and they will turn to you and they will say, I know that my cows are happy. I know I spend right. every day with them. I watch them. They are happy. So when are you allowed to level anthropomorphism and say, oh, you're not really taking into consideration the animal's experience versus saying I'm taking on a phenomenological point of view, you know, because there are many ways to imagine how the cow is experiencing, and both of these views could very much position that they are being ethical. The farmer could say, I'm being ethical. My cow is happy.
Right, right. Right. That's a really, again, very, very interesting points. I really appreciate these questions. So you cut out a little bit there, but I think I caught the gist of it. So we have to also talk about structures of exploitation. So phenomenology is there to inform an ethics and a more rigorous politics of animal liberation. It is not there to determine or dictate the norms per se. It's there to open up our understanding of non-human animal and interspecies, I would say, intersubjective life. It's there to add to the growing list of or the growing body of literature on animal cognition, animal behavior, animal experience coming from cognitive ethology, which I think you'll be talking about in an upcoming program, animal ethology, non-invasive study of non-human animals. Phenomenology is there just to add another language or to use another language to help us understand and get a glimpse of what animal experience might be like without claiming to know everything. This is actually a political thing in itself. Totalizing knowledge is knowledge of oppression and domination. So if you claim to know a being in its entirety, you capture it. And in a sense, you destroy it. So the early Frankfurt School, particularly Adorno, talks a lot about the importance of the remainder, of recognizing that there's always something that cannot be within your grasp. So I think that has significance here. But really what phenomenology does is provide, also just slipped on it again, a language and a framework for deepening our understanding and for bringing to mind concepts that other disciplines or other areas of study may not introduce, such as meaning making. Okay, so we have, you know, Regan talked about subjects of a life, and that was really important, and talked about, you know, animals' wants and needs and desires and even intentions. Then we have ethologists talking all about animal pleasure, you know, like Jonathan Balcom and his wonderful work on pleasure, which is something that's had been anyway under examined until his book came out. So phenomenology just adds to that, but it doesn't claim to have a final knowledge. It's just opening up the knowledge, but it does it with an epistemic humility. This is something itself that's really important.
What I was thinking of there is there's a lot of critical studies that actually say exactly what you're saying now, that partial knowledge, we can never claim to know everything, that our knowledge is always partial. And I think that this is part of why I've often found discomfort in the discourse of instincts. So an animal is only doing something because that's its instinct. There is no choice, there's no intentionality, there's no preference. Either way, it's purely a cookie cutter, a carbon copy of the individual that's next to them, that every single species is doing exactly the same thing. Or not species, every single individual within a particular group. And that's a totalizing discourse that you're speaking of. And I was talking to my husband about this actually. We were talking about kind of the tension between instinct and experience and how to, because, you know, it's hard. You do think that there must be some biological, you know, you speak about an embodied experience. We are shaped by biology. We are shaped by our hormones and these things that we don't necessarily choose. So not everything is of my choosing or of free will. But at the same time, I'm very reluctant to believe that everything is determined by it.
Sure. And this is, in a sense, the classic nature versus nurture question. But with respect to animal ethics and politics, it is really important. And this is actually where my interest in interspecies friendship comes from. Also, just because it's so uplifting to watch other animals interact with each other in loving and caring ways in such a violent human world. But yes, so with interspecies relationships, that really destroys the idea that animals are driven solely by instinct, quote unquote instinct, whatever that really is. Because what happens is, if I don't know if you have seen any of these videos online, but you know, all sorts of animals that may have originally been considered or typically been considered a predator prey on either side of that binary are actually the best of friends because they're in an environment that's safe. Where they recognize immediately that they're part of a community, where the other's well-being suddenly becomes a priority for them. Perhaps in another environment, things would go differently. But this to me is quite revelatory and something that it goes far beyond just, you know, giving human viewers pleasure in watching other animals interact happily, species that we may not typically imagine fraternizing, as it will, or socializing. But that really does give the lie to, or does it put the lie to? Sometimes I forget how to speak English. This idea that animals are governed by instinct, because you even have animals that even if they are hungry, may not actually necessarily kill another animal that is supposedly it's his or her prey. So it goes far and beyond the idea of instinct.
It sounds like you're saying, you know, we're starting to move away from the essentialisms, or hopefully, and, you know, we've seen it with race studies, with gender studies, with post-colonial studies, that any sort of essentializing discourse, which you said is like totalizing, can be destructive, and that every time we see one of these videos, because, you know, I realized as you started speaking, when you were saying interspecies, I was almost immediately imagining a human and a different animal. Actually, what wasn't in my mind was a different animal and different animal.
Right,
somehow
right.
Human was always part of the story, which I think is a fascinating thing to think through, that we place ourselves in the center of what these relationships might be. But to consider how different animals are creating their own communities and their own nations is really profound.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, Will and Sue have written quite a lot about interspecies communities. I highly recommend looking, not just to you, but to the listeners, to look at their work on that, because it's a growing field or sort of sub area focus within critical animal studies, beyond sanctuaries, but into interspecies communities as political spaces. That animals are co-agents in forming and constructing. But yeah, that's definitely, I do think the watching of other animals also brings us back to phenomenology in a sense, because one other thing that I feel is incredibly important about phenomenology is how it kind of evokes a re-enchantment of the world, or it enables, I should say, a re-enchantment of the world. And by that I mean, it brings to life things that we have deadened with our very cold, masculinist, scientific way of thinking, starting at least with Francis Bacon, where the non-human world is really just raw material for experimentation, and now increasingly a genetic intervention in transformation, biotechnological transformation. And Bacon was one of the first to actually envision that happening. And what happens is we live in a world where we see ourselves as this isolated species, the superior species, that sort of it's us, in a sense, again, over and against them. And them constitutes everything else, all other beings and all other species. And phenomenology just has no truck with that. It's just impossible to think that way. if you're thinking phenomenologically, because what's happening is, as I've mentioned before, you recognize that meaning is being co-created in every single situation, that a tree or a rock has a very particular meaning for a particular animal or insect, for example. A different kind of meaning has a different resonance than it would for you. And that rock may have a different resonance for you than it does one day. It might have a different meaning for you one day than it does another day, right? So it brings to life the non-human world. And even without, at the risk of using maybe a problematic world, it brings a sense of magic back into the world, a sense of wonder, we could say. And also epistemic humility, because again, that has political significance, because it challenges this idea that we can and we are entitled to know everything and to do anything that it takes to get that knowledge, to take that knowledge, which is really a form of physical and ontological violence, which is what Francis Bacon proposed and introduced, right? Extract the knowledge as though torturing a woman in the witch trials. Squeeze the knowledge out of her and squeeze the knowledge out of the earth, out of the animal.
Could someone not then say to you, though, that, you know, in your practice of trying to know or understand the consciousness or perception of other animals, even if you're accepting that it's only partial knowledge, that you're doing the same thing as a scientist? You're just trying to access that knowledge in a different way. You're trying to know, but not fully. How is this not violent?
Right. And that does go back to the anthropomorphism question as well, in a way. How am I not projecting concepts, right, that have absolutely no significance per se as concept to those other animals that I'm speaking about? I think there are different, it's a different kind of knowledge seeking. I think there's humble knowledge seeking and there is, arrogant, you could say, or supremacist forms or totalizing forms of knowledge seeking. So humble knowledge seeking is a being with. It's engaging in, this is where cognitive ethology, which is an actual science, comes into play. And I'll let the person you're going to speak to later talk about that. But there is an idea of, you know, non-violent, non-invasive, and non-disruptive observation and even co-experiencing with other animals, depending, right, on the individual animal's preference and not just, I don't like that word preference, but on who that individual animal is and what they are telling you about what they would like or not like. I think we always have to take it, you know, one has to take it in a sense with a grain of salt, because again, these are concepts, these are very elaborate philosophical concepts. But I do think that they come out of a place that is very intuitive. And what, you know, just that we can see, like if we sit down with a cat, I have Bichu is my companion here, my feline companion in Spain. And we just, you know, one thing I love about non-human animals in my time with them is just the spending of time doing nothing but being together. It's just a being with. So we just, you know, we'll sit outside together and he's looking at the same plant that I'm looking at and he's very interested in it. For his reasons. And I know that he's interested because his face is very expressive. His body is expressing his interest. And all sorts of changes are taking place, you know, and he's looking with curiosity, with concern, with fear, with fascination. All sorts of things are happening. And I'm looking at the plant and feeling him looking at it alongside me, but I'm feeling and something different when I look at the plant. So, you know, that's a maybe simplistic example, but I do think that that's actually really what phenomenology is. And together, Bichu and I are creating a little world. We're not consciously, but we're making meaning together just by virtue of sitting there together, inhabiting that space and that time together. But he's got his own, he's on his own space-time continuum, or he lives within his own spatial and temporal world. That's really important as well.
I think it's really powerful. You know, I think it was in the beginning of Carl Safina's book, Beyond Words, he mentioned at some point that we're so readily willing, because you speak about intuitiveness, we see that a dog, you know, dogs and cats are some of the most, the animals that we have the most exposure to, often in urban areas. And you know, will very readily accept, oh, you know, she's thirsty or, oh, he's hungry. And we can read it off their bodies and their facial expression. Yet as soon as it gets to more tricky concepts like love or, you know, or sorrow or loneliness, we kind of retreat a little bit. But it is interesting that if we're so readily able to read them in one, why do we resist so much our ability to read in another?
I just had a little anecdote that backs up what you were saying, or reflects what you were saying. When I was living in Poland, I had adopted a cat that was, well, he kind of adopted me, as the saying goes. He just walked into my house and said, "This is where I live now." And it was wonderful. He was a wonderful companion to me. And I talked with my friends there about the love that we felt for each other. And I remember my friend who you know, was a so-called animal lover, that's kind of ironic, she denied the fact that other animals could feel love. And I remember just finding that shocking. I didn't have the language at the time because I wasn't that well-versed in critical animal studies, or really well-versed at all. And I didn't know how to defend it, but I just knew intuitively that there was something wrong with what she was saying. And that was coming out of a position of denial and so on and so forth. Again, ethology, cognitive ethology and animal ethology is really the place where they get into the emotional experiences. Phenomenology is more about the perceptual embodied experiences, but of course there's slippage in it, and it bleeds into the emotional life as well of their animals.
So I've got one last question before we turn to your quote, because you were speaking about you and your companion looking at a plant, and that raised for me then an interesting question, because if you're speaking about perception or perceived experience, are you only speaking about like animated perceived experience, or would this then extend, you know, to plants as well? Are you thinking about the embodied experience of the plant that was also there in your world making, or is that a different type of question?
That's again another fascinating and important question. I would say I don't have an answer to the question of plant consciousness. I know that there's discussion about that, and I'm very open to learning about that. But it's something that I do need to read up on, so I will withhold really any statement about that. But I will say that in terms of what's ethically relevant, or what's ethically relevant in a particular way, is animal consciousness, non-human animal consciousness and intentionality. And when I say that, I mean that embodied animals that have nervous systems and experience a wide range of emotions, for example. So for the question of animal exploitation and liberation, I think that does need to remain clear that there is an ontological difference. Now, that is not to deny plant consciousness at all. It's just to say that the set of ethical responsibilities are different for non-human animals and plants. And it's not to say that they're not equally rigorous. I mean, we're destroying the lived world around us, and it's horribly tragic. So this isn't in any way a dismissal of, you know, a really comprehensive environmental ethics, and I would prefer just to say a general sort of interspecies ethics and politics, which would include plants. But the particular obligations that we have to non-human animals are different than the ones that we would have to plants. And of course, non-human animal species vary widely. And so we do have to think about the individual needs of those species and so on. And of course, of the individuals within those species. But I do think in general terms, we can say that for our purposes, it is important to make a kind of distinction between what plant consciousness might be and what animal consciousness might be. I think it's fair to say that.
Well, I also think what's really interesting, you know, no one would think of a comparison between human consciousness and plant consciousness. And again, you spoke about intuitiveness. For me, and this is not to say it's right or wrong, there is just something different about how I experience the world with, you know, my chair, which has no living breathing, and a plant that I care for and I raise and I water. And, you know, the dog that's in my house that responds in a very different way to my care and to our relationship. So I think that was well put, that we've just got different ways of experiencing it. We are clocking on in time, you and I. So before we get too carried away, I wanted to give you an opportunity to read your quote.
Yeah, sure. This is actually by Martin Buber, who's not a phenomenologist, but it's the quote that I have at the start of a paper that I wrote on phenomenology and animal ethics. And it somehow just resonates with me and seems to capture the spirit behind my interest in phenomenology and why I think phenomenology is important. So Buber says, "Believe in the simple magic of life, in service in the universe, and it will dawn on you what this waiting, peering, stretching of the neck of the creature means. Every word must falsify. But look, these beings live around you, and no matter which one you approach, you always reach being." That's the quote.
Wow. Wow.
It's a hard one
really
to follow.
No, I think it touches on something because, you know, like, let's say you're walking out. We were on a hike the other day and you're walking and you, just by virtue of being outside of your regular environment, you feel different. And then we came upon a deer and everything else just stopped. We weren't trying to think. We weren't trying to talk. We just stopped and we looked at her and she looked at us and we were trying to each suss out, without thinking really, what the other's body movement was going to be. Was she going to run? If we stayed still, would she stay? And we both kind of just were suspended there in being with one another and considering one another without overthinking it. So I think that quote's quite beautiful.
Thank you for that example. That's a perfect example, really, to kind of concretize what Buber is getting at here. And this is also what phenomenology really teaches us as well, or reminds us, just to, again, indulge in the wonder of it without overthinking it, exactly as you said. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it is wonderful and beautiful and I think it's really subversive to try and think through what another's world is like, whether it's another human or another animal being. I think you've raised here just a whole bunch of interesting words, world making, perception. Sometimes what I think I've seen and what the other human person next to me has seen has not been the same. So it's a kind of a sensitivity that you've drawn our attention to today.
That's right. Yeah, that's, again, a really nice way to capture it. It does. It points to the nuances of lived embodied experience. And as you just said, we can never really know what the other human being with us is experiencing. It's like pain, as people have, say, is a very private experience. But it's an empathy that can nevertheless come out of a shared embodiment, a shared vulnerability, and a shared experience in a world that's absolutely rich with meaning. So it's not just about having food and water and a place to sleep and a slightly bigger cage, right? It's having the opportunity to live a flourishing life in a world in which one can make meanings on a daily basis in whatever way one wishes. And of course, sanctuaries and interspecies communities are good places for that.
Thank you so much for being willing to communicate with. I think part of trying to access different experiences and consciousness is being willing to, like you say, imagine and communicate. So thank you so much. This was pretty intense with a lot of big words, but I think it really frames us well for the beginning of season two, to just start from the position of thinking through and about others' experience and consciousness and perception. So thank you so much for joining me here today and for giving so generously of your thoughts and ideas.
Thank you so much for having me. It really was a pleasure. It was so exciting to have an opportunity to go back to my research on phenomenology, which I have left by the wayside for some time now, living in Spain as a dancer. But it really does remind me of the importance of this discipline, and it's inspiring me to go back and keep reading, or get back to some reading and maybe even writing. So thank you again. And I really look forward to the upcoming episodes.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm super excited. Before you go, if anyone wants to get in contact with you or find out, you said you would be working on some stuff with interspecies friendship. If someone wants to reach out to you or learn more about the work you do, how can they do that?
Yeah, right now the best way is just via email. Should I give it to you, or you have my email, I guess?
I'll put it on the info page.
That would be great. Yeah. I don't have a website for my work. Also academia.edu. I can be contacted that way.
So that's it. We are well and truly into season one now. A huge thank you again to Zipporah for joining me in season two, episode one. As always, I want to say a big thank you to Gordon Clark for the bed music, to Jeremy John for the podcast logo. I also want to thank our sponsors, Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple. And I want to put a shout out there to the iRaw Network. If you haven't listened to any of the other podcasts that are currently dealing with animals, animal-related issues, advocacy, scholarship, go check out the iRaw Network. There's a lot of content on there, and you can really get lost in learning, which is a wonderful thing to do. Also new to everything right now is The Animal Turn now has its own Instagram handle, which is The Animal Turn, as well as its own Twitter handle, which is at The Animal Turn. So you're welcome to connect with us there, or you can connect with me directly, which is at Claudia Town Hurtenfelder on Twitter. Thank you for joining us for episode one. In episode two, we're going to be speaking to Mark Beckhoff about the concept of cognitive ethology. I look forward to chatting with you then. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.